in space, science, and technology was the primary agenda. America's post-Sputnik space failures must be swallowed by strings of successes. Prestige would be the prize. Speaking 16 months later in the open-air stadium at Rice University in Houston, Texas, Kennedy rhapsodized about science, space, and leadership. Along the way, he also mentioned that the year's space budget exceeded those of the previous 8 years combined. But could America afford it? Sure. The $5.4 billion budget, Kennedy deftly pointed out, was less than America's annual expenditure on cigars and cigarettes. Noting the many American space successes since the beginning of his term of office, he invoked the interconnectedness of U.S. leadership with his earlier themes of peace and freedom. This generation does not intend to founder in the backwash of the coming age of space. We mean to be a part of it. We mean to lead it. For the eyes of the world now look into space, to the moon, and to the planets beyond. And we have vowed that we shall not see it governed by a hostile flag of conquest, but by a banner of freedom and peace. We have vowed that we shall not see space filled with weapons of mass destruction, but with instruments of knowledge and understanding. Yet the vows of this nation can only be fulfilled if we in this nation are first, and therefore we intend to be first. By the time Kennedy spoke at Rice, civilian scrutiny of weapons programs and overall military spending had mounted. Add to that the shock of several U.S. debacles, and arms control and denuclearization began to look increasingly attractive, almost as attractive or imperative as being first. Like Eisenhower, Kennedy sent up several trial balloons on arms control and cooperative endeavors. Just a few months after he took office, his State Department produced a document titled Draft Proposals for U.S.-USSR Cooperation, which paints scientific cooperation between the superpowers as both fiscally and strategically sensible and as a path toward working cooperatively in other important fields. One proposal urged early cooperation in fields, e.g., meteorological activities that might eventually lead to weather control or manned exploration of the moon, in which unchecked competition may ultimately be dangerous as well as wasteful. Half a year later, as the U.S. ballistic missile program was revving up, the Kennedy administration created the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, an initiative loathed by much of the military. As one general commented, "The U.S. is attempting the exercise of trying to dress and undress at the same time." By mid-1962, Kennedy's stated space agenda was to permit militarization but to forbid weapons of mass destruction. Khrushchev's was to forbid all weapons. Subsidiary issues added to the complexity. Should the ban on nuclear weapons in space be a separate agreement or part of a general disarmament treaty? What about inspection? What about advance notification regarding all space launches? Everyone in the U.S. administration wanted to preserve some militarization of space for purposes of reconnaissance, communications, navigation, and weather monitoring. Some officials wanted a swift ban on nuclear weapons in space. Others had grave doubts about any ban. But multiplying fiascos, fears, and losses were beginning to force America's hand. Among them were the worsening prospects of the Vietnam War, the attempted invasion of Cuba at the Bay of Pigs in April 1961, two atmospheric U.S. nuclear tests in July 1962 that interfered with radio transmissions, disabled several satellites, and contaminated four Midwestern states with radioactive iodine, and a plan by the Atomic Energy Commission to detonate up to 6 hydrogen bombs at the mouth of a valley on Alaska's seacoast in order to create an instant artificial harbor. Add the humiliation of a Soviet citizen becoming the first human to orbit Earth. Add, too, the growing awareness that space debris and nuclear radiation posed enormous dangers to astronaut flights and orbiting satellites. Soon after the Cuban Missile Crisis pushed the USA and USSR alarmingly close to nuclear war in the fall of 1962, the Soviet Union increased its retaliatory arsenal. Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara glimpsed the possibility of a more stable balance of terror. Diplomatic work to address at least the testing of nuclear weapons, work that had been creeping along since the end of World War II, now rocketed ahead. On August 5, 1963, the Limited Test Ban Treaty was signed in Moscow by the United States, the United Kingdom, and the Soviet Union. What the signatories agreed to was to prohibit, to prevent, and not to carry out any nuclear weapon test explosion or any other nuclear explosion in the atmosphere beyond its limits, including outer space or underwater. Note the absence of a reference to explosions underground. Note also the phrase, any other nuclear explosion. Under the treaty, deadly explosions in space were verboten, but not the wherewithal to create those explosions. A few weeks later, on September 19th, the Soviet foreign minister told the UN General Assembly that the placing into orbit of objects with nuclear weapons on board must be banned and that his government was ready to sign an accord with the United States. The following day, Kennedy replied that, yes, the time to reach such an agreement had arrived. On October 17, 1963, the General Assembly adopted Resolution 1884, sometimes called Stationing Weapons of Mass Destruction in Outer Space, but officially named Question of General and Complete Disarmament. The resolution beseeched all nations to refrain from placing in orbit around the Earth any objects carrying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, installing such weapons on celestial bodies, or stationing such weapons in outer space in any other manner. Language that was carried forward into the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. Did the prolonged effort to ban deadly weapons from space mean that the United States stopped all R&D on such weapons during JFK's presidency? No. In part because the Soviet Union had an aggressive space weapons program of its own, designed by Sergei Korolev, the FOBS, or Fractional Orbital Bombardment System, a long-range ballistic missile armed with a nuclear warhead. A FOBS would spend part of its time in a low polar orbit, the shortest path from Russia to America, undetected by U.S. early warning radar networks. It would then break and discharge its warhead over the continental United States. As for the Kennedy-era space weapons program, both the Air Force and the Army designed nuclear-armed long-range ballistic missiles outfitted as satellite interceptors. They were to be ground-based, launched from Earth into space, but not capable of entering Earth orbit. To some people, this distinction, like the one between offensive and defensive weapons, is elusive and artificial. But to the government of the United States, which repeatedly claimed the right to counteract aggression, as well as the obligation to preserve space as a sanctuary, the distinction was fundamental. Lyndon Johnson did not need a crash course in space mavenry when he assumed the presidency on November 22, 1963, following Kennedy's assassination. During the Eisenhower presidency, he had chaired the Senate's Satellite and Missile Programs Subcommittee. During his own vice presidency, he had chaired the National Aeronautics and Space Council, as well as various other space and military committees. Johnson's entire position might be summarized in 10 of his own words. we cannot be first on earth and second in space. And his clout might be attested by the choice in 1961 of his home state of Texas for NASA's Manned Space Flight Center, now the Johnson Space Center, as the home of America's astronaut corps and mission control. Post-Sputnik, the idea that technological achievement is a straight shot to prestige and primacy among nations became a mantra. But prestige can also result from sharing the benefits of mastery either through collaboration with equals or assistance to those in need. Johnson subscribed to both forms of sharing, and his concept of technological achievement included not just the mastery of space, but also the practical applications of science in the service of civilization. He wanted cleaner air, more access to potable water, and fewer pesticides. While President Eisenhower had used Atoms for Peace and Project Plowshare to paper over the nuclear nightmare and his administration's growing nuclear arsenal, President Johnson signed the Pesticide Control Act and launched Water for Peace. As for nuclear weapons and various other weapons of mass destruction, Johnson, like Kennedy, held that a ground-based weapons system was not a space weapon, even if the active life of the target and its ultimate destruction were to play out in the theater of space. The point was, our side required the means to defend against the other side's space weapons, and we would mount that defense with weapons that did not live idly in orbit. That's how you weaponize space without weaponizing space. By observing that guideline, the United States could maintain that it, unlike the dangerous other side, purportedly bent on world domination, was honoring and preserving the serenity and sanctity of space. Once enshrined in the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, this distinction between ground-based weapons and space-based weapons, however strained, kept the world marginally safer for a couple of decades, in ways similar to the 1963 Limited Test Ban Treaty or the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. Dating back to his days as a senator, Johnson wanted American military might to secure freedom the world over. While chair of the Senate's Special Committee on Space and Astronautics during the lead-up to the passage of the National Aeronautics and Space Act of 1958, he oversaw a committee report that proclaimed, "We have no intent to plant flags of conquest upon the planets or lay extensive claims to the stars. We do propose that space shall never become the route of march for tyrants and totalitarians, and, as we have dedicated our resources in the past to maintain the freedom of the seas and security of the skies, so shall we dedicate our capacity to maintain the neutrality of space." Johnson's opponent in the 1964 presidential election, Senator Barry Goldwater, a brigadier general in the Air Force Reserve and a man comfortable with the use of nuclear weapons, was not a fan of neutrality. In his view, space research should be directed by the military with national security and control of the access to space as primary goals. What America needed ASAP were anti-missile missiles, laser weapons, the laser itself, had been invented by American scientists at Bell Labs just 4 years earlier, and a manned space station in near-Earth orbit. Daily surveillance of nearby space would be crucial. According to Goldwater, America had to move beyond just sailing into space. The idea that the United States could collaborate with the Soviet Union was too ludicrous for comment. Goldwater opposed disarmament. He voted against bills and treaties aimed at fostering peace. He thought that low-yield nuclear weapons should be used to defoliate key areas of South Vietnam and wanted senior military commanders to be pre-authorized to use nuclear weapons in an emergency. Sounds extreme, but Goldwater was not an outlier. The president of the Aerospace Corporation demanded to know, why do we place an evil cast on military activities in space? A senior air power advocate and Reader's Digest editor called the U.S. space program too peaceable and the wrong race with Russia. Goldwater lost overwhelmingly. Once elected, Johnson, an arm-twisting, New Deal kind of Democrat, and as anti-communist as his predecessors, presided over the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, the 1964 Food Stamp Act, the 1965 Voting Rights Act, and the 1968 Fair Housing Act, all part of his War on Poverty. On his watch, Medicare and Medicaid were introduced, the federal minimum wage was increased, 35 national parks were established, and the National Endowment for the Arts and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting were created. Also on his watch, the country would witness the escalation of the Vietnam War, the ostracizing of Cuba by nearly every nation in Latin America, eruptions in America's cities and on America's campuses, and, shortly before the end of his term in office, the successful launch and return of the Apollo 8 spacecraft and its three astronaut crew, who became the first humans ever to orbit the moon, the first humans ever to leave Earth for another destination. Johnson halved the official poverty rate, but also sent 1.5 million Americans to Vietnam and convinced Congress to give him a wide berth to do whatever he deemed necessary in Southeast Asia. He further strengthened America's thriving space program, and he pushed America farther down the path of substantive arms control, both on Earth and in outer space. Not merely bans on testing nuclear weapons, but prohibitions against using them at all. Under Johnson, the Air Force competed with the Army and the Navy to become the space power within the Pentagon, a fight for primacy that dated back to its formal split from the Army in 1947. Beginning in 1958, the Air Force faced an additional civilian competitor, NASA. But putting a man on the moon became NASA's mandate, not the U.S. Air Force's, even though half the astronaut corps came from the Air Force, and Johnson was strongly committed to it, despite opposition from many quarters. Soon, NASA's outlays far surpassed the Pentagon's space budget. In an attempt to swing the pendulum back, the military unsuccessfully stepped up its efforts to dominate America's crewed space program, efforts doomed to fail because the president's Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, was on the lookout for Pentagon programs that could be cut, not expanded. The race to reach the moon had become the core of Johnsonian space policy, and NASA's share of total space spending soared to 74% in 1965, with much of the remaining going to military reconnaissance satellites. But the largesse couldn't last. For 1967, NASA requested $5.5 billion, but received $5 billion. As James Clay Moltz writes, "The boom years for space could not go on forever. In domestic politics, Johnson's Great Society programs in particular had caused social spending to soar. Even in peacetime, the simultaneous drains on the federal budget of space programs and expansive new social programs were bound to cause eventual fiscal strain. With the growing cost of the Vietnam War, cuts had to be made somewhere. Dual pressures from liberals favoring more social spending and conservatives favoring more military spending began to catch NASA in a scissors. In keeping with Johnson's and Kennedy's vision of a single, broad, unified space program, the Vietnam War presented both the need and the opportunity for cooperation between NASA and the Pentagon. The title alone of a 1964 joint NASA-U.S. Air Force document highlighted in U.S. Presidents and the Militarization of Space, 1946 through 1967, by military historian Sean Kalick, makes clear the military benefits of open borders between military space and civilian space. Summary of suggestions by NASA headquarters personnel as to ideas that may have application to the war in Southeast Asia. Among the possibilities proposed by the co-authors were satellites that could identify instantaneous cloud cover, synchronize altitude communication, and locate downed pilots, and research into supersensitive seismic sensors, lightweight power supplies, and infrared technology. By the mid-1960s, infrared detection devices such as tank-mounted searchlights and the earliest handheld thermal imagers appeared in the American war against communism in Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. Off the battlefield, new varieties of danger to space assets were gaining visibility. Any and every spacecraft, military or civilian, U.S. or Soviet, faced the possibility of collision with orbital debris. Thanks to the 1962 series of missile-launched American nuclear tests collectively called Operation Fishbowl, we learned that the brief electromagnetic pulse of a high-altitude nuclear test could temporarily paralyze unshielded communications and reconnaissance satellites, while the detonation's longer-lasting radiation would suffuse the upper atmosphere and make human spaceflight even more problematic than it already was. Down on the ground, even an unfueled rocket sitting on a launch pad could become a site of disaster. During an Apollo 1 launch rehearsal on January 27, 1967, three astronauts asphyxiated within seconds from an electrical spark gone wild because the pure oxygen atmosphere in their sealed capsule spread fire instantly, igniting the interior nylon netting, the Velcro straps, and the polyurethane foam insulation. No thinking person imagines that being President of the United States, especially in wartime, is a job for the faint of heart. Johnson's presidency, rife with tumult, was marked by a widely questioned war and social upheaval, as well as pioneering safety net programs and technological triumphs. Like his predecessors and successors, he walked both sides of the space street. Carrying on the post-war practice of U.S. technological anti-communism, he promoted what Walter A. McDougall called the benign hypocrisy of cooperation in science and competition in engineering. Johnson's support of cutting-edge military reconnaissance and his public acknowledgement of successful American ASAT tests served as accident insurance for peace initiatives. For him, national security demanded the presence of the military in space, but the absence of orbiting weapons. Just days after his sudden ascension to the presidency, Johnson told the space industry that the United States would uphold its commitment to the peaceful purpose of space for the good of all mankind. The United States would have to appear to the world as the champion of peace, so as to nudge the Soviet Union away from its work on bombardment satellites. One way to look peaceable would be to open previously military programs to general public use, the civilian spin-off argument. Two such programs were Transit, the U.S. Navy's satellite navigation system, and Nimbus, a system of NASA satellites that recorded and photographed cloud cover, atmospheric chemistry, ozone, and sea ice. Another way to look peaceable would be to keep supporting the kinds of cooperative scientific ventures that had started during International Geophysical Year and had continued under Kennedy, not the moon landing program, which Johnson wanted to remain a unilateral first, but less high-profile programs such as satellite studies of Earth's magnetic field, satellite relay of communications, and as discussed by Soviet and U.S. scientific delegations from December 1964 through September 1966, a joint civilian mission to space. A third way would be to press directly and conspicuously for a UN treaty on arms control in outer space. By this point, contends Moltz, political leaders had begun to recognize that space was now too valuable to be used for war. In December 1963, the UN General Assembly adopted a declaration of principles affirming that the exploration and use of outer space should be carried on for the betterment of mankind and for the benefit of states, irrespective of their degree of economic or scientific development, and asserting the shared desire to contribute to broad international cooperation in the scientific as well as in the legal aspects of exploration and use of outer space for peaceful purposes. The time was ripe for a full-fledged treaty. The pieces were in place. And so, on the afternoon of January 27, 1967, in the East Room of the White House, U.S. Secretary of State Dean Rusk, followed by U.N. Ambassador Arthur J. Goldberg, representing the United States, U.N. Ambassador Sir Patrick Dean, representing Great Britain, and finally U.N. Ambassador Anatoly F. Dobrynin, representing the Soviet Union, put their signatures to the Treaty on Principles Governing the Activities of States in the Exploration and Use of Outer Space, including the Moon and other celestial bodies. Representatives of 57 other nations then added their signatures, and President Johnson said a few words. "We have never succeeded in freeing our planet from the implements of war. But if we cannot yet achieve this goal here on Earth, we can at least keep the virus from spreading. We can keep the ugly and wasteful weapons of mass destruction from contaminating space. And that is exactly what this treaty does. This treaty means that the moon and our sister planets will serve only the purposes of peace and not of war. It means that orbiting man-made satellites will remain free of nuclear weapons. It means that astronaut and cosmonaut will meet someday on the surface of the moon as brothers and not as warriors for competing nationalities or ideologies." Today, 5 UN space treaties are in force, along with hundreds of resolutions, initiatives, conventions, reports, declarations of principles, and arms control treaties that include language directly addressing space. Among the arms control treaties are the 1963 Limited Test Ban Treaty, treaty banning nuclear weapon tests in the atmosphere, in outer space, and underwater, and the 1972 Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, treaty between the United States of America and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics on the limitation of anti-ballistic missile systems. While it was still in force, the ABM Treaty banned the development, testing, and deployment of widely distributed ballistic missile systems on land, in the seas, in the atmosphere, and in space. It also banned interference with the signatories' national technical means of verification, which, though unspecified, meant satellite photography, aircraft overflights, and electronic and seismic monitoring. Many nations regarded the provisions as indirectly including a ban on space-based anti-satellite weapons. Upon the Bush administration's withdrawal from the treaty in 2002, that ban evaporated. Among the resolutions, PAROS, Prevention of an Arms Race in Outer Space, is of considerable interest. Its several-decade history highlights America's preference for stonewalling on disarmament. First presented in December 1981 as a plea for measures and guarantees that would deepen those delineated in the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, Paros was reintroduced in essentially the same form every year thereafter until finally in January 1994 it came to a vote. No country opposed it. The United States alone abstained. Year after year, the General Assembly voted on this resolution. In 1996 and 1997, the United States was joined in abstention by numerous allies. But beginning in 1999, it was joined consistently either in abstention or in outright opposition only by Israel, with the occasional addition of Micronesia, the Marshall Islands, or Haiti. Also starting in 1981, and accelerated by U.S. disinformation regarding the Strategic Defense Initiative, coupled with genuine as well as artificially inflated Soviet alarm at SDI and the space shuttle, the Soviet Union asked the UN General Assembly to place on its agenda a Soviet draft treaty that sought to prohibit stationing weapons of any kind in outer space. By the summer of 1983, no longer a draft, it bore the title Treaty on the Prohibition of the Use of Force in Outer Space and from Space Against the Earth. In 1984, the USSR proposed further clarifications. If just the 1983 provisions had been promulgated as a treaty, its signatories would have been agreeing not to test, place in orbit, or station on celestial bodies any space-based weapons for the destruction of objects on the Earth, in the atmosphere, or in outer space. Not to use already orbiting or already stationed space objects as means to destroy any targets on the Earth, in the atmosphere, or in outer space. Not to destroy, damage, disturb the normal functioning, or change the flight trajectory of space objects of other states. Not to test or create new ASATs, and to destroy any ASATs they might already have. And not to test or use manned spacecraft, read the U.S. Space Shuttle, for military or ASAT purposes. In 2008, Russia and China, working through the UN's Conference on Disarmament, presented their draft of a successor to Paros called the PPWT, Treaty on Prevention of the Placement of Weapons in Outer Space, and of the Threat or Use of Force Against Outer Space Objects. Its prospects can be gauged in part by paragraph 34 in a 2015 Russian-Chinese letter describing the lack of useful input from the United States. Instead of constructive proposals on the contents of the draft PPWT, we once again see the appalling attempts of the United States of America to impose on the international community its politicized assessment of the space programs of certain states. The United States, they say, is avoiding having to shoulder any additional international legal obligations as far as outer space is concerned, including in order to ensure that outer space remains free of weapons of any kind, and is doing nothing to facilitate progress towards a mutually acceptable resolution of issues involving the security of space activities. Rough language from diplomats. Other concerned parties made other proposals. A senior German diplomat, Detlef Wolter, drew up detailed guidelines in 2006 through 2007 for a treaty on common security in outer space, regarding the need for an explicit prohibition of active and destructive military uses in outer space, Wolter suggested that signatories commit themselves to refrain from any deployment or use of any object in space or on Earth that was designed or modified specifically for the purpose to inflict permanent physical damage on any other object through the projection of mass or energy, respectively. Adding to the explicitness, he also suggested that ballistic missile defense and anti-satellite systems be forbidden in outer space, the sole exception to be a UN system whose purpose would be implementing and enforcing a non-proliferation regime and protecting against unauthorized and accidental missile launches. pending ratification of anything that resembles current attempts to consecrate space as a permanent haven of peaceable activity for the common good of all humanity, the centerpiece and foundation of international space law remains the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, the high water mark of the United Nations sponsorship of the demilitarization of outer space. To date, it has been signed and ratified by 105 countries, including not only the United States and Russia, but also China, India, Pakistan, Israel, the United Kingdom, Canada, and every country in Western Europe that isn't a microstate, and has been signed by an additional 25, a total of 130 of the United Nations' 193 member states as of early 2017. Ideally, ratification should signal that each of these countries recognizes and honors the common interest of all mankind in the progress of the exploration and use of outer space for peaceful purposes. But, as with other peace-seeking agreements, it is honored almost as much in the breach as in the observance. Have a look at several of its provisions. Article 2. Outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means of use or occupation, or by any other means. Article 3. States, parties to the treaty, shall carry on activities in the use and exploration of outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, in accordance with international law, including the Charter of the United Nations, in the interest of maintaining international peace and security and promoting international cooperation and understanding. Article 4. States parties to the treaty undertake not to place in orbit around the Earth any objects carrying nuclear weapons or any other kinds of weapons of mass destruction, install such weapons on celestial bodies, or station such weapons in outer space in any other manner. An ordinary person would interpret these clauses as saying that nobody may own or control any part of space, violate the peace there, undermine international cooperation there, or introduce weapons capable of catastrophic damage there. Do not assume governments and militaries share that interpretation. The U.S. Air Force, for example, embraces more open-ended guidelines for observance of the Outer Space Treaty, if and when the treaty is mentioned in its documents, which is not always the case. Take the Air Force Doctrine document, Space Operations, 2006, which states that although the space legal regime imposes a few significant constraints, the bulk of this regime provides a great deal of flexibility for military operations in space. The document then turns Article 3 of the treaty regarding the role of international law in the preservation of peace on its head. The right of self-defense, as recognized in the United Nations Charter, and more fundamentally in customary international law, applies in outer space. Also, law of war precepts, such as necessity, distinction, and proportionality, will apply to any military activity in outer space. As for Article 4 regarding weapons, the Air Force clarifies that the placement of weapons other than weapons of mass destruction in outer space is permissible, as is the transit of nuclear weapons such as ICBMs through space. Finally, with regard to the treaty's overall goal of upholding peace, it asserts, the majority of nations have traditionally held that the peaceful purposes language does not prohibit military activities in outer space. Such activities have taken place throughout the space age without significant international protest. The phrase, rather, has been interpreted to require that activities in space be non-aggressive, to refrain from the threat or use of force except in accordance with the law, such as in self-defense. At the heart of U.S. military objectives is an expansive definition of self-defense. Active, not passive. To embrace that definition means the potential use of weapons, and potential use opens the door to an actual program of weaponization. In 2002, the RAND Corporation's Project Air Force Division published Space Weapons, Earth Wars. Intended as a tutorial for anyone concerned with national security, it focuses on facts, options, feasibilities, tactics, costs, positives, negatives, and possible scenarios. Everything you need to know about war making from space. The first sentence informs us that since at least the late 1950s, the Air Force has espoused the full use of the medium of space for national security. Hardly a shock that an ambitious Air Force anywhere in the world would view the medium of space as part of its workplace and would seek full use rather than limited use. Also hardly a shock that national security is the stated goal and rationale. Who among the sane does not wish that their country and its inhabitants be kept safe and well? But national security is a malleable concept. From the U.S. Air Force's point of view, many national security uses of space are not open to debate, at least when it's the United States doing the using. Those uses include communications, environmental monitoring, position location, weather, and warning, as well as intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, and weapons guidance. Several of those activities may sound like benign defensive measures meant to protect the state and its citizens, but in fact, all of them possess potential offensive military value as well. Early on, the report proposes that the most urgent reason to develop space weapons may be the possibility that other nations will decide to acquire them. That's like saying, we'd better not only keep up with the Joneses, but also acquire an Olympic-sized backyard pool before they do. The report also contends that the military's periodic statements on doctrine and strategic planning give space weapons an air of inevitability. So, picture this. Two adversaries possess weapons capable of immense devastation. Neither side will hesitate to use those weapons to their fullest. Both await a reason to do so, such as an aggressive move by the other side. The likely scenario is inescapable escalation toward a renewed state of mutual assured destruction, MAD, in the course of which the line between defensive and offensive weaponry will be blurry at best. As the political essayist I.F. Stone wrote back in the 1950s, when U.S.-Soviet nuclear war felt almost imminent, both sides in every war always claimed to be aggressed. Uncompromisingly hard-headed, Space Weapons, Earth Wars simply presents a panoply of available or conceivable options for the waging of space battles. Its brief historical overview takes the militarization of space as axiomatic. The use of space in conflict and the use of weapons against space systems are both historical fact and current reality. From its beginning, man's use of space has included conflict, wars, cold and hot, finding targets, warning of threats, relaying commands, aiding navigation, and forecasting weather. If militarization is the basic condition, if all past and current activity in space has a military and therefore potentially aggressive character, then outright weaponization of space is simply a logical extension of an already existing condition. By that line of reasoning, attempts to demilitarize space are naive, and attempts to exclude weapons from it are quixotic. But do everybody's space weapons have equal access? The United States habitually treats the possession of advanced weaponry by non-allies as an intolerable threat. Iran and North Korea are today's examples. The RAND authors take note of accelerating international concern during the 1960s that space be preserved solely for peaceful purposes, but have almost nothing to say about the wisdom or likelihood of abiding by the resulting treaties. One of the uses of space weapons of current interest to the United States is explicitly illegal, states a report with studied even-handedness. Not that explicitly expressed reservations are entirely absent. On grounds of clear self-interest, for instance, it opposes the use of a deadly space weapon against any high-altitude target carrying biological or chemical agents because much of the resulting hazardous debris would be broadly dispersed by wind and its harmful effects broadly distributed. As a deterrent, warns the report, the possibility of poisoning one's own homeland should give a rational actor more reason not to employ such weapons. An optimist might contend that nobody except a rational actor would ever be permitted to make such decisions, but anybody who has watched the 1964 movie masterpiece Dr. Strangelove or witnessed the rampant irrationality of the 2016 U.S. presidential campaign is unlikely to agree. Joan Johnson Fries, analyzing what would induce countries without space assets to acquire them, argues that the combined existing, imminent, and projected U.S. space capabilities would make it effectively not only unassailable and able to impose its will virtually without question, but also capable, if it chose, to undertake highly intrusive forms of coercion without the burdens of occupation. After all, space capabilities can readily be repurposed. The same rocket can launch a nuclear-tipped missile or a crop-monitoring satellite. The same adaptive optics can eliminate a star's twinkle or a laser weapon's dispersion. Other countries, alarmed by, but also dependent on, America's abundant space assets, would understandably want to develop their own space assets to help preserve their sovereignty and autonomy. Europe, Japan, France, Israel, China, and others have already gone that route. Keep in mind that a single nation, the United States, far outspends all others on military space systems. We are the big buyer. We are the patron. We're also the biggest exporter. And our own definitions of self-defense lean toward preemption. But beyond that, says the RAND report, it is conceivable that the United States could decide to acquire space weapons in advance of a specific compelling threat. That is, in a deliberate, unilateral, preventive move to maintain technological superiority. Besides, not all decisions to acquire would be deliberate. They could arise incidentally from the development of commercial, reusable space systems, not yet widespread when Space Weapons, Earth Wars was being written, but now proceeding rapidly at corporations like Blue Origin and SpaceX, and at the space agencies of France and Germany. To quote the report again, any capability to deliver and retrieve large quantities of material economically to and from space could be adapted to emplace and deliver conventional weapons from space. If you can go back and forth cheaply and easily, you can take almost anything along for the ride in either direction. Laser weapons or multivitamins doesn't really matter. Once the problem of transportation has been solved, the question of the advantages and limitations of space assets arises. One imagined advantage is ready access to targets via overflights, because ever since Sputnik, political constraints on overflights apply only to lower altitude aircraft. Another advantage is global reach, which holds true only if the assets are sufficiently numerous and strategically deployed. Two others are the potential for swift response, compared with the time needed to mobilize terrestrial forces, and the adversary's difficulties in defending against space weapons. One big limitation is the stable, observable, predictable orbit of each satellite. To assemble a constellation of already orbiting satellites would mean having to change some established orbits, a formidable task requiring more fuel for thrust than a satellite typically carries in orbit. Other limitations include the $10,000 per pound cost of placing any object in space and the need to have plenty of satellites in orbit, preferably hardened against attack, so that at least one will lie within timely reach of any likely target. Still other limitations, in theory if not in practice, are the treaty provisions that prohibit putting weapons of mass destruction in space bases and that assign liability for damages under certain circumstances. Finally, the paucity of time between decision and deployment can be good or bad or both. But aside from the disputable morality of various space weapons, and aside from the budgetary constraints and the optimal tactics for guaranteeing preemption and preeminence, there's a more basic question. Even a middle school kid who's been told about Hiroshima and Nagasaki and the firebombing of Tokyo, about defoliants and napalm, about bunker buster bombs and sarin gas attacks, might ask, what kinds of space weapons are the people in power willing to use today? Is there a line they will never cross? Statements to the effect that the United States must commit itself to space supremacy and embrace the full spectrum of space weapons, or indeed weapons in general, have never been in short supply. Full spectrum dominance is the main theme of the Joint Chiefs of Staff's Joint Vision 2020. At times, U.S. rhetorical insistence on space superiority has sounded more like an insistence on space exclusivity. As one Air Force officer wrote during the George W. Bush administration, the United States does not explicitly support other nations' rights to operate militarily in space, reserving this right for itself. Militarization is often exponential. Intensified, it breeds weaponization. Each further step on the continuum escalates the danger from simply operating in space to operating militarily to operating aggressively to operating lethally. Beyond limited lethality lie extermination and annihilation, the predictable outcomes of waging war in space using the full spectrum of available and conceivable weapons. For more than half a century, the nuclear bomb has stood at the far end of the full spectrum, whether launched from a submarine or a silo, dropped from a plane, or delivered via suborbital missile. It is the emblematic weapon of annihilation. The scale of damage in Hiroshima and Nagasaki is well known. By contemporary standards, both cities represent mild demonstrations of what nuclear weapons can deliver. But even smallish nuclear explosions can cause serious collateral damage. On July 9, 1962, for example, in a nuclear test known as Starfish Prime, the United States exploded a 1.4 megaton hydrogen bomb 400 kilometers up in the air, disabling half a dozen orbiting satellites and stoking the already disruptive population of electrons in the Van Allen radiation belt, which encircles Earth many thousands of kilometers above our planet's surface. Nevertheless, tests and plans continued. U Thant, who was then Secretary General of the United Nations, described the U.S. program to test nukes in space as a manifestation of a very dangerous psychosis. That psychosis ruled the body politic for a couple of decades. From the time President Truman learned about America's atomic bombs in April 1945, he expected to use them. Though initially built to devastate Germany, which was now on the verge of surrender, the bombs would instead be deployed to shorten the war with Japan. As Cold War historian Walter Lefebvre put it, Roosevelt had built this bomb to be used. Truman was going to carry out Roosevelt's policy. Billions of dollars had been put into the bomb project. Truman was not going to waste that money. 3 years later, in 1948, during the U.S. airlift of supplies to West Berlin following Stalin's blockade of surface traffic, Truman told his Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State that while he prayed the bomb would not have to be used, nobody should think he wouldn't order a bombing if it became necessary. By the early 1950s, America had 400 nuclear bombs and a fleet of intercontinental B-29 bombers that could be refueled in mid-flight. Nor was this nuclear psychosis an exclusively American illness. On July 24, 1945, at the trilateral negotiations on reparations, post-war reconstruction, and borders that took place in Potsdam, Germany, just 2 weeks before the United States dropped Little Boy and Fat Man on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, President Truman casually, he thought, dropped mention of the fact that the United States now possessed a horrible new weapon. Stalin's response appeared so nonchalant that Truman thought he might not have understood the comment. Far from it. Stalin immediately ordered the USSR's existing atomic project to accelerate its work. Whole forests were soon cleared to make way for laboratories. Electricity was redirected from civilian areas. Just hours after the atomic age began, writes Lefebvre, its arms race was escalating. Soon, U.S. policymakers and generals were speaking out and strategizing in favor of maintaining a nuclear arsenal, not simply as a deterrent, but as a commitment to act. Hundreds of detonations followed forthwith. August 1949, Soviet, with an explosive yield equivalent to 22 kilotons of TNT. November 1952, U.S., 10.4 megatons. August 1953, Soviet, 400 kilotons. March 1954, U.S., 15 megatons. November 1955, Soviet, 1.6 megatons. November 1957, British, 1.8 megatons. February 1960, French, 70 kilotons. October 1961, Soviet, 50 megatons. October 1964, Chinese, 22 kilotons. The kiloton blasts were typically A-bombs, exploiting the fissionable properties of uranium and plutonium, elements named, by the way, for the planets Uranus and Pluto. The more deadly megaton blasts were H-bombs, which derived their energy from the thermonuclear fusion of hydrogen to helium, same as the sun's been doing in its core for the past 5 billion years. Seeing this proliferation of nuclear testing, the conservative public policy group American Security Council, proponents of a full-spectrum U.S. stance, demanded that atomic test ban negotiations at Geneva be discontinued and that underground nuclear tests be resumed immediately. Some military strategists agreed. Nuclear weapons, small enough to be transported on ballistic missiles, were already available. The good news is that by the early 1960s, few in the U.S. military saw the installation of nuclear bombs on a satellite as a reasonable option. After 1967, the option was dead. Recalling his frame of mind just after World War II, the merciless General Curtis LeMay, commander of the singularly deadly firebombing of Tokyo and subsequently the first head of the U.S. Air Force's Strategic Air Command, SAC, told interviewers, "SAC was the only force we had that could react quickly to a nuclear attack. It did not make much sense to me to be in a position of not being able to act because I had no weapons. When I first came back from Germany, 1948, there wasn't any doubt in my mind that if we had to go to a full-scale war, we would use nuclear weapons. We didn't consider any unit really combat-ready unless it had a nuclear capability, because we were planning on a nuclear war." In 1953, the Executive Secretary of the National Security Council, James S. Lay, Jr., issued a top-secret presidential directive, NSC 162/2, that warned of the Soviet Union's intent to dominate the world, its growing nuclear stockpile, its suspicious peace gestures, and the possibility that it might soon be able to deal a crippling blow to our industrial base and our continued ability to prosecute a war. This multifaceted Soviet threat had led